joke. So he told me, and I asked him if I could tell it. I think it's kind of cute. Was about the judge. Excuse me, Judge. Seems that there was an alcoholic judge. Of course, you know it's fictitious. Judges don't drink. But there was this alcoholic judge, and he was bad to get drunk, and when he got drunk, he always did something wrong, like throw up on himself or something. And his wife told him, "One more time, Ace, and that's it. I'm leaving. Just once more is all it took." So sure enough, Judge went out, had a couple of drinks, and woke up in his car a little while later, and he puked all down the front of himself. Oh, God, what's he going to do? So he got in the house. She was gone. He got in the house and got his clothes off just as she drove up in the driveway and threw him in the back of the closet. Got his bathrobe on, ran into the bath like he was cleaning up and all like this. And next morning, you know, she rolled him over and she said, "I found some clothes messed up in your closet." He said, "Yeah, honey, I want to tell you about that." Said, "Yesterday," said, "I had a case. It was a drunk. And said, when I sentenced him, he was up pretty close and he just puked all over me. I gave him 30 days. She said, "You should have given him 60. He messed in your pants, too." Keep buying the raffle ticket. We'll have another raffle tonight with about 6 or 8 books, and then also the Praying Hands tonight. I don't know exactly when that'll be. I haven't been told yet. 6th Annual Al-Anon Convention, Alabama, Northwest Florida, will be February 22nd, 23rd, 24th, 1980. Holiday Inn, Santa Rosa Boulevard, Fort Walton Beach. New Year's Eve dance at Lake Gunnersville, Alabama, up in North Alabama. December the 31st, 1979, see Catherine Fernie. Fair tickets. Second anniversary, Hartzell Hope Group. That's up around Cullman, Alabama, where we live. Rockathon on the 24th of November, 1979, here in Panama City, at the Beach Civic Center, on Florida 79, between U.S. 98 and U.S. 98A. It's probably a very short distance between those two. It'll be on 24th of November at 7 p.m. Speaker and program will follow. It doesn't say who. Oh, I have another one to tell that I thought was kind of cute. All these are given to me. Y'all are wonderful. I don't have to worry about jokes. All I really need to do is write them down and sell them. Was about God decided that the time had come to reveal himself to his people again. But first off, there are thousands and thousands and millions and billions of people on this earth, and it would have been a lot of crowd and people getting stomped and all like that. So certain conditions were made, and that was that God would meet with one reporter. And this reporter was to release the message and all like this. So at the appointed day and the appointed time, this one reporter was led into this room to meet God. And about 30 minutes later, out of this room came this thoroughly shaken, white, humble reporter. And everybody gathered around and said, "What happened? What happened? You know, tell us the message," all like that. And the reporter said, "Well, first off, she's black." I'll go back to dirty jokes. Never mind. Are we getting anywhere close to getting somebody up here that's funny? Huh? Oh, another announcement. I thought that was pretty cute. I'll try it later. Y'all go back to the room, think about it, and then we'll go through it again. All right, I'll tell you one other one. Is that you? Did you? Tom, I've seen you. Huh? This is one that I told last year, and some folks asked if I tell it again this year, was about these two Cajun people. We got Louisiana people here today? Okay, so I'll use the correct word, Coonasses. Yeah. These two Coonasses have been out in the swamp trapping, and they had just pelts like you wouldn't believe. Took them into New Orleans, sold their pelts, and both of them ended up with a wad of money about this big. And so one of them asked the other one, said, "What you gonna do?"
He said, "You follow me, man. I'll show you how to have so fun." So took him over to the hotel, you know, and he walked in, and both of them dirty and in dirty clothes and beard and all this, walked in, walked up to the fellow at the desk, and he said, "Hey, man, what I want is a big room, a case of whiskey, and the best looking damn woman you got." And this desk clerk said, "Have you got any money?" He took out this big roll, and the desk clerk said, "Yes, sir, sign right here on the book." So he turned the book around and put his mark on it. So his buddy watching him, you know, stepped right on up there and he saw the same damn thing he got. "I want a big room, a case of whiskey, and a good-looking woman." He said, "You got any money?" Showed him his roll, big old roll about the book. "Yes, sir." He said, "Sign the book." Turned the book around, he said. His buddy looked at him, you know, and he said, "Hey, man, so what the hell are you doing?" He said, "You don't think I'm going to give my right name?" Can we get on with the program? Huh? Let's get on with the program.
I told you he's been sober for 30 years and has about 3 days before Christ made corporal. And I'm just not going to distract from Pete and his time here. And without any further ado, I'll give you Pete Slater from Montague, Michigan.
Thank you, Bobby. My name is Pete Slager, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to come down here and extend my sobriety for one more day. Normally told you that I had been sober for a little over 30 years, but my sobriety date actually dates back to 1945. One day at a time. I really don't like to tell my story for one reason. That I like to tell it because there might be somebody in the room, and I understand we have some inmates here from the correctional facility. But by my relating my story, they might find a way out too into a better way of life. I started my drinking very early in age. In fact, my father was a bootlegger, and my father cared not too much about what us kids done. I am one of 9 children. None of them are alcoholics. I'm the only alcoholic in the family. I have a couple of thick-headed brothers that don't believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. One little story I have to tell you about my one brother who is 2 years younger than I am. He was always forever berating me when I would get knocked off by the police and I would get my name or my picture in the paper, and he raised the holy hell when he found my name in the post office. See, I graduated from local to national fame at one time. And whenever we'd go over to his house after I'd sobered up, he'd say, "Come on, have one drink. I'll see that you don't get drunk." And I said, "No, I can't handle it, Hank." And he kept after me and pestering me for a good many years about taking a drink. So I went over there one Sunday and I said, "Okay, I'll take one, just one." So he went over to the refrigerator to come back with a bud. He said, "Here, I'll even pull the top open for you." He pulled the top open for me, and I walked out through the living room and through the kitchen and out to the back door, and I dumped it on the ground. He has never offered me another drink since. I sure want to thank Jim for asking me down here, calling me and writing and telling me about the love that you had here. I see it up here. Before in my life, there was no such thing as love. Hate was my word. I hated everything and everybody. I even had it tattooed on my fingers. But several years ago, I had a great physician, a good surgeon in the city of Kalamazoo. That's when Ann and I were still going. And by the way, I want you to see my beloved wife, Ann. Stand up, Ann. You see, I didn't get an old automobile. I got a new one. Ann's 23 years younger than I am. That's pretty good in itself. I first want to tell you a little bit about my family before I go into my story. I have 5 children, three by Ann and 2 by myself. By a former marriage, I should say. Well, it was just here a few short weeks ago that my oldest daughter, who incidentally is the same age as Sam is, we were reconciled together. It took all these years. I had to make a searching and moral inventory of myself when I met my granddaughter for the first time. Beautiful little doll, 17 years old, a good artist and a good equestrian. You see, I even know them big words now. In case you don't know what an equestrian is, this is a horse rider that jumps over these things, you know. I was a horse, too. I was always jumping over things like prison walls, jail gates. I'm an ex-jailbird. I have served over 20 years in the penitentiary. I've committed about every crime in the book, and I don't know the reason why God has let me be here today. Actually, I should have been probably put in an electric chair or in the gas chambers. I never cried before in my life. I can never remember crying until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found love, first time in my life. At the age of 9, I remember getting drunk. It was quite a deal in my life, my dad being the bootlegger. My brother Joe and I, we broke into his booze cellar and we stole some of his booze, and I wound up in the back seat of his own Maxwell. I was like that judge that puked all over the front of himself. I puked all over the old man's Maxwell. But we didn't have switches in them days. We had a hardcore burner, and my dad took that old iron stove poker and he worked me over with it. But I noted one thing about taking that first drink. It made a different person out of me. I became bolder. I could even sing better. Yeah, and I could even tell bigger lies. And consequently, by the time that I'd reached 15 years of age, they didn't know what to do with me anymore because they had put me in detention homes and locked me up for periods of time, and I would always break out. I just didn't like to be caged up like an animal. And at the age of 15, a little over 15 years of age, I was bound over from juvenile court into circuit court, and I received my first sentence in the state prison of Southern Michigan for armed robbery. I wanted to be three things that I wanted out of life. I wanted to be rich, I wanted to be smart, and I wanted to be tough. And I know that standing before you today, I have attained all three of these goals, but not in the sense of which I had intended in the first place. First, I want to be rich. I want to have a lot of money. I want to be smart enough to get it, and I want to be tough enough to get it. But today, this afternoon, standing in front of you, I am rich in the sense that I have over 1 million friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm tough enough to resist that first drink with your help and the power of God as I understand him. And I'm smart enough to know that I'm an alcoholic and I can't take that first drink. So I have attained all three of these goals in a certain sense. And when I went to prison, there was a big smile on my face. I was really tickled to death. I made big time. Usually when anybody goes to prison, they're very downcast. They cry and they sob and they bitch about these things. You're going to have to excuse my language a little bit. I am not completely rehabilitated. And when I talk about screws, I'm talking about guards in the penitentiary. When I talk about the cuter, I'm talking about the prosecutor. When I talk about the judge, I'm talking about the old man. And I'm also talking about policemen. We used to call them bulls. We call them fuzz now. Isn't that right, young folks? We call them a fuzz. And the judge. I don't want to tell you what we used to call a judge. When I got to the old prison down on Cooper and Ganson Street in Jackson, Michigan, I spent 3 days in a little 4x8 cell, and then I was taken out and related some rules and regulations. Incidentally, my number was 13213 when I went there the first time, and I was put on task. Now, those of you that know what binder twine is, there's six rolls and a bale, and my task was to put it from one level up onto another level, and I had to do so many bales in 15-minute period, or you got 10 swats across the you-know-what. I didn't complete my task the first day, and I got 10 belts across the butt. But I assure you that after that, after getting 10 belts across the fanny with that cat of nine tails, I didn't miss my task after that. I had blisters on my hands, but there was no SOB. Now, that sweet old boy was going to make me cry. I wasn't going to cry. I laid there, and I took that cat of nine tails for the 10 swats across the butt. But after that, I always got my task done. And I didn't hang around with the young fellows in the prison. I hung around with the older fellows because I want to learn how to rob safes, break open safes. I want to know how to rob banks. I want to know how to hold up different places and so forth. I wanted to learn the whole trade. And by the time I'd completed my first sentence, I was told to go back to the city of Kalamazoo and behave myself and report to my parole officer. Well, there was no such things as big cars, big money, or good-looking dogs in the city of Kalamazoo. Besides, it was a dry town. I couldn't get anything good to drink there. So I went to Detroit. And I remember the first night out that I was in Detroit, I went down with a group of fellows I got acquainted with in prison. Some of them had been released. And they told me that I had to prove myself in order to become a member of this group there on the east side in Detroit. I was given a blackjack and told to go out and hit somebody, slap somebody, and bring back the evidence. I did. I was successful in the operation. And then I was given a gun and told to go out and hold up the filling station. Again, I was successful in the operation, and I became one of the boys down on the east side. Very shortly after that, I was picked up by the Wayne County Police and charged with armed robbery again, and again I was sent back to Jackson Prison with a new sentence and a parole violation. And by this time, they were beginning to build the new prison down on 4000 Cooper Street, and of course, I was put under shotgun and with a lot of other fellows, and we were building the prison out there. And I can remember one incident very clearly where a fellow by the name of DeMalt, Chuck DeMalt, who was a guard at that time, he had that shotgun just cocked over his arm, and he just dared me to run. He said, USOB, I want to blow your head off, because I've been giving them people an awful lot of trouble. It was about that time that I met up with my sponsor again, who had been on the outside. He was a fighter. And he was peddling booze in the joint. Now, in case you don't know what spud juice is, I thought that was a concoction of the gods. You take one drink of that, and man, you're set for the day. It was made out of spud juice. I drank Applejack or Sarlacc or anything they had in the prison that had an alcoholic content. But no thoughts in my mind that I was an alcoholic at that time, because I was still striving for those three goals in my life, of being rich, smart, and tough. I went along for about 7 years there, and I finally received another parole, and I never got out of the city of Jackson on that parole. The transfer officer took us down on Blackstone, put us on the bus, supposed to be going to Kalamazoo, and he was the morning out of sight, and I told the bus driver, let me off quick. He let me off the bus, and I turned around and went down into Jackson, went down to one of these cat houses down there, because this is what we think about those of us that have been in prison. There's two things that we want when we get out. We want a jug and a broad. I tell the fellows down at the prison now, whenever I go down there to prison, leave the jug alone, the broad is that much better. D.C. Pettit, who was the assistant deputy warden at that time, came right down to the city of Jackson for a lock up there. I was picked up for being drunk and disorderly, and I was trying to fight my way out of a scrape that I'd got into, and he brought me back with the belt, the legs, and the leg irons and the handcuffs, and all the boys were laughing at me when they brought me back to the prison. I wasn't gone over 12 hours. And of course, I had no new rap on me at that time, and by the time my sentence was finished, I'd become a young man of a pretty good age. And when I was discharged, I was given a $10 bill and a new suit of clothes. If you can call it a new suit of clothes, it was new to me, but it was a prison made, and I didn't like it. And the minute I got downtown in Jackson, I traded that off for a pair of trousers, a shirt, and a necktie, and I went back to Detroit, and I got in with the boys again, and it wasn't very long, and I was picked up on a very serious charge. I happened to beat that rap physically, mentally. I've never beat it, because I was picked up on a second-degree murder charge. Actually, to tell about it now, the statute of limitations have run by the boards, and I can tell you about it now. I actually was guilty of it, as you are sitting right here today. There's many of my crimes that I have committed that I actually was guilty of it, that I was never caught by man, but I was caught by God. Now that I know what I had done in my past years. On my first stretch into the state prison of Southern Michigan, we had a little guard in there. His name was Stevens. And he was about 5 foot tall and about 5 foot wide. And he was forever going around digging at himself, scratching at himself. So all guards in prisons have nicknames. We used to call him Scratch Ass. I had a rap partner at that time, and I said to him, if this little so-and-so ever lays a hand on me, I'm going to cut him up in little pieces. And I used to carry what we call a shield. It was a knife made out of a file, and it was razor sharp. I used to carry it on the inside of my leg. And anybody that would listen to me, I would say, if that little so-and-so ever lays a hand on me or touches me, I'm going to cut him up in little pieces. One day we were going into the big top in the kitchen where they beat 2,500 prisoners at once, and Scratchy committed the unpardonable sin. I reached in, I got my shiv out, and when I got through with him, it took 106 stitches to sew him up. For this little caper, I was placed in solitary confinement in 15 blocks. 93 days later, I was taken before the trial board of the prison, which consists of the warden, the deputy warden, the psychiatrist, and the psychologist. My lawyer was a psychiatrist. And I received an indefinite period in solitary confinement to maximum security prison up at Marquette, Michigan, which is incidentally is called the Siberia of the North. It's one of the world's worst prisons. I was placed in G Ward. I was given a haircut. You can call it a haircut if you want to shave your head. They give you a pair of sneakers and a blue coverall. And their mattress in there is two oak boards and a 12-quart pail. This is the sanitary facilities that you have in there. And the door is solid steel except for one little opening that they raise it up to look at you. They don't want you to get too comfortable in there because every once in a while they see that you're sleeping in the corner. They'd get the hose in there and spray you with water. 4 days on bread and water, and the fifth day you got one meal. 4 days on bread and water, and the fifth day you got one meal. This is the way I lived for over 2 years. I got so agitated in there, and I was wondering how I could escape from that place. Many times I yelled out and called these people every time I could hear them going by the cell, calling all kinds of names. That didn't seem to attract my attention. So I'd back up against the door, and I'd hit my heel up against that door, and it would go blam, 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 and this went on for hours at a time. Till finally, one day, four guards came down there, and they pulled me out of the cell, and here come two fellows with a settling torch and some welding rods and so on, and they put four rings into the steel floor, and then they placed me in there, and they tied me to the floor. And for 91 days, I lay on that floor, bread and water for 5 days, 4 days, and the fifth day I got a meal. And this is the way I lived for a while. And I have the scars on my hips to show for the holes that I had from laying on this floor. They were going to rehabilitate me or they were going to kill me. There was no such thing as rehabilitation in my book. But I remember on the sixth day of January when they finally turned me loose from there, and by this time I really needed a bath, I really needed a shave, and I really needed a haircut, and I had some friends about that big that was crawling all over me. They took me down below the G Ward gallery, and they placed me under the shower after they'd shaved my head and let me stand under that shower as long as I wanted to. That was the only good thing that I ever found out about that whole term that I was in solitary confinement. That was not to be my last term in solitary confinement. I remember as they put the belt, the handcuffs, and the leg irons on me, and as they were taking me by the warden's office, Warden Bushko walked out and he said, "Just a minute. I have a few words that I would like to say to Mr. Slager." And he hauled off and he hit me on the side of the cheek. And I said, "Warden, what the hell is this for?" He said, "This is for causing us all the trouble while you were in the hole. And I'm going to repeat the same words that I said to him. I said, you son of a bitch, I'm going to come back and I'm going to kill you, you dirty, rotten so-and-so." He said, "I might as well get another lick in," and he hit me on the other cheek. I went back to Jackson Prison, and of course I had to do 10 days in the solitary block up there before they turned me back, and I was placed in 4 block. And it wasn't long after that, 12 of us fellows decided that we didn't like the state prison of Southern Michigan anymore, and we thought we'd better separate our company from them, and we planned an escape. We wasn't successful in the escape. I remember that we got the high-powered rifle away from the man up in the rotunda, Sammy S., I'm not going to give you his last name, because the man is still in prison. He took the gun, he was a crack shot, he said, and as we got up on the administration building, Captain Boucher was looking up and hollering, "You son of a bitches, get back in there, we'll shoot every damn one of you." And Sam pulled up that gun, and blam, we hit Captain Boucher right in the forehead and drove him right back and killed him. We see that there was no way out, because by this time they were recording the sheriff's deputies there, there was state police, there was guards around the prison. There was no way we could escape. So I run back, four of us run back, and we dropped down on the rotunda floor, and on the morning hit the floor, and there was about eight guards that jumped on me and started kicking me and pummeling me, and by the time I was through, I'd lost my left eye, almost every bone in my body was broke. And again, I was placed in 15 blocks, and I'd done 93 days, and my face stuck way out here. Finally, Dr. Huntley came from the infirmary. He took one look at me and he said, "Move this man back to the infirmary at once." He took me back to the infirmary, and I remember laying there 2 days, and he said, "Well, we're going to move you back to the University of Michigan Hospital. They're going to go to work on your face." Well, I had two guards that went along with me to the University of Michigan Hospital, and they went to work on my face. And they fixed it up so I could wear an artificial eye. And today I have a memory of that day in the state prison of Southern Michigan. You would think that would be enough to make a man stop and think, but it wasn't enough for me. I had to go back one more time, and this time I received a life sentence. I killed a man. I blew the top of his head off. And I remember this very distinctly. I was told to go out and get this man because he was interfering with our operation in Detroit. And I hit him on top of the head with a sawed-off shotgun, and he lay there and shook. And I remember Bulldog said to me, "Hit him again, Patch." He said he's still shaking, and I blew the rest of his face off. It was shortly afterwards I was taken out of the Wayne County Jail and taken before Judge Gillis. Grand old man, God rest his soul. He said, "I hope that you never get out of prison. You are like a mad dog. You have no business out in society. We hope that you never will get out, and we hope you die before they turn you loose." And I asked him if I could say a few words before his sentence, and he said, "No, you can't." And he finally sentenced me to a life term in the state prison of Southern Michigan. I knew he couldn't say any more. So I said, "Judge, you know, there's one thing wrong with you. When they circumcise you, they throw the good part away." I had no respect for anybody or anything at that time. I went back to Jackson Prison, and I got in with the boys again, and the first thing you know, I was peddling dope. I was doing a lot of things in prison that normal people don't do. Because after all, wasn't I a big shot? I didn't know how to live. Nobody ever taught me how to live. They always said we were going to rehabilitate you or we're going to kill you. And I guess they couldn't rehabilitate me and they couldn't kill me. So I guess they were going to let me live my life out. But there's one thing that I always hated to have the inmate population say to me. That if a man don't do his full time, that when he dies, they stand him up until his time is in. And that bothered me a lot. I didn't want to be stood up after I had died. There was a kindly old priest in Jackson Prison at that time by the name of Father Cahill. He's a terrific old man, God rest his soul. He's a good man, he's gone too. A lot of my good friends from the prison are gone. But he called me to his office one day, and when you are called to an office in prison, you go. There's no such thing as saying no. So I took my pass and I went to Father Cahill's office, and he said, "You know, there's one thing wrong with you, Pete." And I said, "What's up, Father?" He said, "You're an alcoholic." I said, "You're crazy in hell. I can take it or I can leave it alone." He said, "I don't know of anybody in this joint that ever drank any more spud juice than you have. I don't know any man in this joint that has drank more shellac or Sorlax or anything else with an alcoholic content than you are." He said, "You surely are not altogether totally insane. I still see a little bit of good in you. And if you want to do something about your life, I will help you." And I told him, "Go to hell." Went back out to the inmate population again, and I told the boys about this. And about this time, I was wearing a patch over my eye before they put the artificial eye in there. And it was shortly after that that I received a artificial eye that was fit in my head. It was glass at that time. I wear a plastic eye now. At that time, I received a glass eye. And I remember coming out of my cell one morning and going out into the yard for my daily walk around the yard, and I hit that cold air. When that cold air hit my glass eye, it busted in my head. And I said I would never wear another one again. And I wore a patch for a long time, and that's what my name became, Patch Eye. Of course, every prisoner in there usually has a nickname, and there's some names that are not printable. But I had one real good friend in there by the name of Chip R. He's gone now, too. He died not too long ago. In fact, he was a little rap partner of mine. And he said, you know, Pete, there's got to be a better way of life than living in the penitentiary. He said, hell, he said, we haven't seen no women around here for months. We haven't seen no good whiskey. We haven't had a ride in a good car and all these kind of good things that is not happening to us. Well, I said, I don't know what's going to happen to me, I said, but I've got the book. I don't know how in the hell I'm going to get out of here. There's a lot of things that I don't want to tell you about that happened to me in the prison because I'm afraid some of you are still blabbermouths. I don't want to tell you the whole truth about it. But I will tell you this, that we had a regular bar in there behind the laundry, and they set up drinks for us during the ball games and the football games and so on. Then I would get a drink, and I would set it up on the board we called the bar. And then I would have to go to the John. And every time I'd go to the John, I'd come back, my drink was gone. Hell, that cost me a pack of cigarettes for that drink. So I devised a great way of saving my drinks. Whenever I got some spud juice in a glass and I had to go to the John, I'd take my eye out and lay it alongside it. You watch that while I go to the John. I never lost a drink after that. But I lost three eyes. I don't know what good that would do anybody else, these eyes, and nevertheless, everything has its price in the penitentiary. I went along till 1945, and all at once, Tip came to me, and he said, I heard some news about you today. I said, what's that? He said, you're going to receive executive clemency. I said, why? He said, I don't know, but you're going to receive executive clemency. And he didn't want to get it out of his mouth, and he said, I heard over the loudspeaker, 5736, you report to the hall office. And I went to the hall office with a lot of things going around in my mind, wondering what I'd done now that I forgot about. And he said, you're running up to the parole board room. I went up to the parole board room, and I can't tell you to this day who interceded for me, and I much less care. But I thank God from the bottom of my heart, whoever it was, I received the executive clemency, and I would be paroled in 30 days. And I remember that day on the 15th day of December 1945 when I was released from the state prison of Southern Michigan. A. Ross Pascoe said to me, he said, we're going to see that you get back to Kalamazoo because we believe that if you'll get back to Kalamazoo, you might have a tendency to straighten out. You'll be back there with your family, those people that care enough about you that want to help you do something. I was getting out, and I as much as told them I didn't care who met me or anything of this kind. But we're going to see that you get back to Kalamazoo. Sergeant Jim McCoy, the transfer officer, is going to take you back to the bus marked Kalamazoo. He is to instruct the bus driver not to let you off that bus till you get to Kalamazoo. And when you get to Kalamazoo, your parole officer is going to be waiting for you. I guess they didn't trust me. All these things came to pass. And I remember that day when Sergeant McCoy, with his high-pitched voice, said, don't let this son of a bitch off the bus, because if he gets off the bus, here's the number we want you to call immediately, and we'll come and pick him up, and he'll do every damn day of this time. I got to Kalamazoo, and guess who was waiting for me? You're right, the parole officer. A great, big, tall, brown giant of a man. He said, my name is Tony Vonk, and he said, I'm sure you and I can work together, and I'm sure we're going to get along real good together. But first, I want you to come to my office in the Peck building. I have a few rules and regulations that I'd like to tell you about. So we went up to the Peck building, and he told me about not hanging around with any known criminals, not to hang around any bars or take a drink and all this kind of jazz I thought it was at that time. And then he said, I've got a nice room for you up in the Midway Hotel and take you up there right now. I had $1,606 to my credit when I left the place, and they don't give you this money when you leave. They give you just enough to get to your given destination. And then the parole officer, he gets the rest of it, and when he figures that you can handle your money again and you're well enough straightened out, he will credit this to your account. So as I looked out of that room up the second floor of the Midway Hotel, I looked out the window, and guess what I saw? You're right, I saw a bar. It was called the Trophy Room. And I began to get very thirsty, because I hadn't had any good whiskey for a long, long time. Mine was all spud juice and salt lax and everything else, shellac, and anything that had an alcoholic content. Tony started out the door, and he said, by the way, he said, I forgot the most important thing in the whole program. I said, what's that, Tony? He said, I got a job for you. Well, hell, I never had a job before in my life. I said, what's it doing? He said, you're going to be a trimmer's operator's helper at Council Paper Company number 2. Well, hell, the only thing I ever trimmed was people. And I wasn't about to go out and work for a living. I was too smart yet. So he in the morning got out of sight, and I called him back again. I said, Tony, one more thing I'd like to have. I'd like to have some money to eat on. I don't have enough money. He said, I've taken care of that, too. And he reached in his pocket and he came up with 2 little cards that called meal tickets. He said, when you run short, come on up to my office and I'll give you a couple more. This is not working for me. Something is wrong here, radically wrong. And I said, I want to get out of these prison clothes. I need some money to buy some clothes. He said, I've taken care of that, too. Hep's clothing store is right around the corner. You have a charge account there. Now, he is no more than out of sight, and I can see this gray Ford pulling away from in front of that hotel. And I was down on the phone, and the next thing you know, I've got in contact with a couple ex-con friends of mine. I had a C-note, in case you don't know, that's a $100 bill. And the next morning, I woke up in the Kalamazoo County Jail, charged with driving while drunk in a stolen automobile with a loaded .45. You talk about the wonders of this program. They placed me in a solitary cell. The next morning, I was taken before Judge George V. Reimer. He took one look at me and he said, I don't even want to look at you. He said, I've known you practically from the day you were born. You come of good parentage. You have some good brothers. You have some good sisters. I don't know why you are acting like you are. He said, I think that you're insane. Why they ever turned you loose from the state prison in Southern Michigan, I don't know. Give you 30 days for driving while drunk. And Deputy Flowers started to take me out of the courtroom. He said, one thing more, young man. He said, we'll have to ask you for your driver's license. I thought I had it there. I said, hey, Judge, I don't have one. He said, that'll be another 30 days. About a week went by, and finally Tony came up to see me, and he said, you know, Pete, I had high hopes in this for you. I thought probably you and I could work together. We're even of the same nationality. I said, what the hell's that got to do with it? I was always ashamed of being a Hollander, a wooden shoe. I'm not anymore. He said, I had great expectations for you. I thought probably this is the time with all the breaks that you've gotten in your life, with all the years that you spent in prison, that you might have a tendency to straighten out. Then I kind of hung my head and I said, yeah, I guess maybe I should have, Tony, but I just don't have it in me. He said, you've got it in you, but you just won't let it out. He said, have you heard of Shy Walker? Oh, yeah, I know Shy. I've known him all my life. He'd kidnapped Harry Moon to the tune of $152,000, and he was given 5 to 10 years. This is before the Lindbergh Law came into effect. And he was my bootlegger in Jackson Prison. He got out 2 years ahead of me, and he joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, yeah, I know him, Shy. He said, you know he belongs to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, what the hell is that? Well, he says, it's an organization, he says, that helps drunks just like you. He said, would you talk to Shy? I said, sure, I'll talk to Shy. I'll talk to anybody. Well, I've never seen Shy dressed up in my life. But this particular day, well, before, all he wore was a pair of blue jeans and a sweatshirt. He was an ex-fighter. He talked out of the corner of his mouth. And he came up there that day. He had on a nice brown suit and a brown hat and a pair of floor shine sure that the idiot had a blue book under his arm. Oh, man, this guy's gone nuts. He's gone ape. Hello, Peter, how you doing? I said, how the hell do you think I'm doing? I'm going back to the joint again. He said, well, strange things happen once in a while. He said, you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, oh, I heard a little bit about these drunks in the joint going to prison. He said, well, I belong to it. He said, I got a book here I want to leave with you. We'll leave it. And he had his pockets full of other literature, too. And he also had the 20 questions from John Hopkins University in deciding whether a person is an alcoholic or not. He said, I want you to answer these to the best of your ability. He said, I'll leave this pencil with you. And he said, you mark them down, which ones are yes and which ones are no. And he'd crossed off, he'd taken off the bottom, he'd cut it off, the answers to it. So I answered 17 of these questions, yes. Such question as, do you crave a drink at a definite time daily? Damn right, I like to drink all the time. Is drinking making your home life unhappy? Damn right, the warden didn't like it. Do you drink alone or with somebody? I'll drink alone if I got the money. If you got the money, I'll drink with you. Such questions as that. They were silly, idiotic questions to me at that time, and I'd answered 17. The next day, here was Shy up there again. He said, well, Peter, how you doing? And I said, well, Shy, I think I flunked your test. Why? I only answered 17 of them yes, and he handed me the bottom of it. And you know what it said on the bottom. If you've answered one question yes, there's a possibility you may become an alcoholic. If you've answered two questions yes, there's no doubt about it. You possibly are, and three, there's no doubt about it. And that stopped me from thinking for a while. But I know that standing before you today, if there are 4,000 questions pertaining to alcoholism, they would pertain to me in some shape or manner. So I have accepted the whole ball of wax. But it wasn't that easy. On my 58th day of incarceration, Tony came up to see me and he said, well, how you doing? And I said, I'd like to get the hell out of here and go in the bullpen and leave with the other guys in there. He said, well, maybe we can turn you loose. I said, what are you talking about? We're going to hold these other two charges in abeyance. I said, how can you do that? He said, well, you're a charge of the state and we've talked with the judge. We're going to give you the old proverbial one more chance. But you are to attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are not to take a drink. You are not to hang around with anyone with a known criminal record. And you are to go live at Shy Walker's house. Now, if that isn't contradiction, I don't know what is. Because Shy Walker, he was a man that had 5 to 10 years on a kidnapping charge. He stole 45 cents off of a judge one time and picked his pocket. Judge only had 45 cents. You see, these judges don't make much money. And he got 5 to 15 for this, strong arm. He said, you are to go live at Shy Walker's house, and you are to attend AA meetings. And the first meeting that you miss, you're going back to Jackson. So on the 60th day, here come Glenn Coffey and Shy Walker. God rest their souls. They are now gone. They've taken the 13th step, and they are up above looking down. I went to live at Shy Walker's house, and it wasn't easy. Getting out with these two guys, two of the biggest lushes in the county, and I thought I was the smartest hood that ever lived. Instead of taking me into the front door, 1015 North Park Street, they took me around in the back and down in the basement. I said, what are we doing down here? He said, well, you got to take a bath before Betsy will let you upstairs. I said, Shy, I've done nothing to get dirty. Take a bath anyway. So I'm going to humor this guy. After all, he did help get me out of jail and kept me from going back to Jackson Prison. So I went in there and I threw a little water on myself and it came out. I said, where's the... I didn't even get the towel out. And here, Glenn stood over here and Shaw was standing over here and they had toilet brushes and Ajax cleanser. He said, you one-eyed son of a bitch, either you take a bath or we'll give you one. So I went in there and I threw a little water on myself and it came out. I said, where's the... I didn't even get the towel out. And here, Glenn stood over here and Shaw was standing over here and they had toilet brushes and Ajax cleanser. He said, you one-eyed son of a bitch, either you take a bath or we'll give you one. I want you to know that I took the best bath I ever had in my life. The next day I woke up, and when I got upstairs, there was that big, warm hug from Betsy. God bless her. Oh, what a terrific woman she was. She had a lot of love, what you are showing here this weekend. And Shy's house just oozed with AA. He had signs all over his house, and there's a good many drunks that attribute no sobriety to Shy Walker. And they still are doing it today. Went upstairs. Shy told me to pick out a suit that I like. And along all three of these walls, he had suits, he had shoes, he had hats. This guy had gone around to all these different merchants and bummed his clothes off of people for his boys. And I picked out a suit, picked out a hat, picked out some underwear and a pair of shoes that fit me. Most of it was new. Then I went upstairs and Bessie gave me that big hug, and I had a nice room upstairs. And the next day when I come down, I had a nice breakfast. There was no more raising my cup for a cup of coffee or turning it upside down for a glass of water. This is our usual procedure in prison. It's a silent system there. When you want coffee, you hold your cup straight up, and when you want more water, you turn your cup upside down. You have one implement to eat with, and that's a spoon. And if you are anybody or somebody in the prison, your number is stamped on there. You can buy it for 15 cents. Incidentally, I think that one of my boys, what we'd like to say is one of our boys, Tom Rye, I think he spoke here last year, he has a status symbol with his number on it, too. Anyway, the first meeting was on a Saturday, and this was on a Wednesday. And during this time, Shy and Glenn never let me out of their sight. There's one or the other, and I wanted to drink so bad, I just couldn't hardly stand it. I even looked in his medicine chest to see if there was any shaving lotion or something that I could get to drink, anything with an alcoholic content, because I figured I needed it real bad. But there wasn't. He was too smart for me or anybody else. It came to his house. It was an alcoholic. Saturday, I went to my first meeting. I'd read some of the literature and read something about the book. I think one of the first things that caught my eye was the third tradition of AA, where it said, we don't care how violent you've been, how many institutions you've been in, how crazy you've been, or any of these things, you're a member if you say so. And it also said in there that you share your experience, strength, and hope with each other. These are the things that I remember. And I went to my first meeting of the old Austin Theater in Kalamazoo. And when I got there, I looked in this room, and lo and behold, there were five ex-cons sitting in that room. And there was one in there. He had a blonde on one side and a redhead on the other arm. And I thought he ought to share. But he politely informed me that that was not the kind of sharing that they'd done in AA. I went to meetings for over 2 years. I never listened. When it came my turn to say the thing, I say, I pass. Finally, I got to the point where I said, my name is Pete, and I have a trouble with drinking. I wouldn't say I was an alcoholic, because I didn't figure I was one yet. I could take it or leave it alone. They finally got me a job in the Burdick Hotel as a bellboy. I was making about $16 a day in tips, and the hotel paid me $35 a month, and I got my room and board. Now, this wasn't bad in those days. It was pretty good amount of money, but it wasn't enough for this big shop. So I noted that Kalamazoo was a dry county, so I started bootlegging from the hotel. Then I made a few extra bucks on that, and still it wasn't enough for this big shop, so I started a couple games up on the fifth floor. Things were going along pretty good, but it still wasn't enough money for me, so I recruited 31 broads and I went into the pimping business. I remember one day very distinctly, I was standing in front of the hotel, pimping myself in my tailor-made suit. Everybody else knew what I was doing, except me. Two detectives, one by the name of Laurel Aldrich and one by the name of Ray Clayton, and I will thank them to my dying day for what they said to me. Pete, if you don't get yourself straightened out, we're going to send you back to Jackson Prison, and we'll make damn sure you never get out. Oh, man, I'm in AA. And they knew a little about AA because they said, you're not in it, you're on it. You're using AA as an excuse. We'll give you 30 minutes to get over and see Shy Walker, or we're going to throw you back in Jackson. I run that 3 miles. You see these people running out in the front here? Sissies. They don't know how to run. I ran all the way to 1015 North Park Street, and when I got there, I said, Shy, the damn fellas are picking on me. And boy, he let go with both barrels. He grabbed me by the arm or shoulder, and he shoved me in a chair, and he said, for the first time, you're going to listen. Never once have you been to a meeting where you participated Never once did you offer any suggestions. You always say, my name is Pete and I have a drinking problem. Don't you think it's about time that you paid something back for what you have received? And he kept on and on like this, and pretty soon Glenn came in, and he started to unload on me. Well, next thing you know, Larry Norton was there, he unloaded on me. Then Henry Van Dyken came in, he unloaded on me. We sat there till 8 o'clock the next morning. And for the first time in my life, I began to listen a little bit. And I began to hear some strange sounds like friends, love, laughter, happiness. And I began to think for the first time in my life. I never had a visit from my parents or any of my brothers or sisters all the time I was in prison. I didn't want to see them because they'd never done anything for me. Everybody had to do something for me or there was no good in my books. I was forever shooting angles and getting things that I didn't deserve. I got all the breaks, but still I didn't want to listen. And around 9 o'clock that morning, the next morning, I began to listen for the first time in my life. And Shai said to me, you've taken so much, but you've given so little. Don't you think it's about time that you got into this thing with both feet and helped somebody? Just think, you haven't been back to prison for a long, long time. You haven't even been in jail for a long, long time. Somebody must be doing something right for you. So, I listened as the dying would listen. And I remember going back to my first meeting after that, which was a day and a half later. As we sat around this big table above the Atrium Theater, it came around to my turn. Instead of just sitting down and saying, my name is Pete and I have a drinking problem, I stood up and I said, my name is Pete Slager and I'm an alcoholic and I don't give a goddamn who knows it. Everybody stood up and they applauded. Stand there for 2 minutes. In fact, one guy told me one time, he said, why the hell don't you resign from this outfit? I said, I never joined up. And from that moment to this moment, I have started to learn how to adjust my life to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and how to live like a human being should live. I've become reconciled to my brothers and my sisters. I've become reconciled to an awful lot of people. A cousin of mine who has the same name as mine, you can imagine how he felt. He was a teller in the bank in Kalamazoo the first night of the bank. How he must have directed some adjectives at him. Well, I see he got picked up again last night, Pete, and I can imagine some of these things. So when it came time to make amends, he was the first one I went to. And I think that's the first time in my life that I ever cried. First time in my life I ever cried. He put his arms around me. And I never heard him swear because he belongs to the Christian Reformed Church and they don't believe in swear, they don't believe in dances, they don't believe in circle, they don't believe in a lot of things. But he said to me, you son of a bitch, it's about time you got yourself saved out. You have caused me a lot of trouble. He and I are good friends today. And it took a long time for me to become reconciled to my two sisters who were living at that time. Because one of them had almost killed her husband. In fact, he wore a scar from his ear clear down to his throat where I beat him over the head with a flower stand, an old flower stand, because he accused me of breaking in his house. And I told him he didn't have anything in there that I cared about, not even his family. And I became reconciled to my brother Jack, my brother-in-law. I became reconciled to my sister Grace. I became reconciled to my sister Elizabeth. My dad and mother were still living at that time. And I remember just before my mother passed away, I went up to Bronson Hospital to see her. She had cancer. She took hold of my hand. She said, Peter, I don't know what you found, but whatever it is, hang on to it. It's the best thing you've ever had in your life. My mother was a very easygoing woman. I forgot to tell you that my dad damn near made it to Leavenworth, Kansas because he was knocked off as a bootlegger. He got 5 years probation. So my dad and I are both ex-convicts. I went to work with Alcoholics Anonymous. I started working with drunks around the city of Kalamazoo. I started going to meetings in other places with Shai and Wren. And I remember the first time Shai asked me, he said, how would you like to go back to Jackson Prison? I said, to do time? He said, no, to go visit the angels over there. I said, what the hell have I got to give them? He said, you've been there, man. You've been there. So I agreed to go along with him, and strange thing happened that day. They wouldn't let me in.
Thank you.
First time in my life I couldn't ever get in prison. And I raised so much hell out in the front that Dan, the sergeant up in front, he said, "Pete, if you don't quiet down, let me call the police and have you be arrested for a disorderly person." And I sat out there while Shy and Dan went inside to carry the message to the boys' recovery group. When they came back out, I'm still fuming. I wouldn't even want to talk to them all the way back. And he said, "Well, we'll fix it up for next month for you to go in. That time you were allowed to go in once a month. Now we go in every week." Anyway, the next time I went, they let me in. But I was given the once over, twice over, and third over again. They really shut me down when they brought me in. And I asked Van, I said, "Why didn't you let me go in the first time?" He said, "You raised too much hell when you was here before." I haven't told you the whole true picture of my incarceration in Jackson. I was one of the leaders of a riot in there. It cost the state over $2 million. And I thought this was a pretty big deal. So you see, if I had to make all my amends cash-wise, I'd still be paying that back today. But I'm trying to pay it back today in my sobriety and working with other alcoholics who are still incarcerated. Many times I ask people to go along with me to Jackson Prison or go to Marquette or go to Iona or go to Muskegon Correctional Facility. You know what their standard answer is? And you probably heard it. "I don't know what I'm going to tell these guys." What the hell do you tell them in the meeting? We've got to remember that these people that are locked up are human beings the same as you and I are. And I like to say the only difference between them and you, you never got caught. We conducted a little experiment last August in our conference. I was program chairman. And if I do say it myself, we had one of the best programs that we've had in a good many years. But we asked all the ex-convicts in the room, "Would you please stand up?" And I imagine about 20, 25 stood up. "How many of you have been in jail?" And a whole bunch of them stood up. And I said, "How many of you people should have been in jail?" And everybody stood up. At that time, I said, there is not a one of us that hasn't faced disaster at some time or another in our lives. It's how we face this disaster is what counts. I may have gone down the road a little bit farther than some people, but I've got the same 12 steps, the same 12 traditions that you have. Mine doesn't deter one way or another than it does yours. Yours and mine are both the same. I have to tell you about the first time where I really had a good cry. Now, you've got a hell of a thing to talk about. A great big tough guy like me, you know, crying. Well, it hasn't been too long ago. I had a very good friend in Muskegon, Michigan. I'm still living in Kalamazoo. And the name was Judge Henry L. Beers. God rest his soul, he's now passed away. We used to go to Henry's Lodge up there in Muskegon, just outside of Muskegon, up on the White River. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. Hell, I didn't even know you had grass and trees out there until they got silvered up. But Henry had a beautiful place out there where he could fish, he could just loaf. He had a sauna bath out there, and man, it was terrific. He said to me one day, he said, "Pete, how would you like to come to Muskegon and work for me in the circuit court?" I said, "Doing what?" He said, "I'd like to have you talk to the young people that I get in front of me." He said, "I think that you have a message for them." I said, "You're crazy, Henry. Me, an ex-convict?" He said, "Yes, you're the man that's been down the road. Wouldn't you like to work with them?" I said, "I'd like to keep kids out of going to prison, going to jail, or even getting into trouble." He said, "Why not come on down?" I wasn't married at that time. I met my wife in Borges Hospital. She was a student nurse, and I was under anesthetic when she asked me to marry her. I always hear about this. She came to Muskegon shortly afterwards, and we were married. We were married by a judge. We killed him off, too. Judge Matthew Felot. Also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Terrific man. So I finally took the job as a deputy sheriff. Get that, an ex-convict, a deputy sheriff. I have a card in my pocket that says I'm still a deputy sheriff. I went to work with these young people that came to Muskegon County and got in trouble with the law. First thing you know, Ann and I had two kids in our home. Not our own. I'm not talking about the ones that were born of us, but two kids that came to our home that had troubles. We started working. Reggie, for one. Oh, he was a tough little. I could just see an awful lot of Pete Slater in him. He was headed down the same way that I was, and we showed him a lot of love and affection. Today, Reggie is married. He has three children. He has a good job. He's the superintendent of a sheet metal outfit in Kalamazoo. He's doing just outstanding work. And he's working with other young people. And this goes on and on. And before you knew it, we had 8,000 kids all together in a little program we called United Youth. And we used the same program that you are using. But we had a few more restrictions than what you got here. And we had a few more things. And of course, in my knowledge of how to get inmates together, I took the same knowledge and put it together, get these kids together in a big hurry. I would call up four of our members of United Youth, they in turn, each one would call four, and then each four would call four more. Within, about a matter of about 6 to 8 minutes, we'd have 2,000 or 3,000 kids meeting at Hackley Park. And we became to be recognized by the United Appeal and the people of the town. And a few years later, I was given recognition of doing Mission Week as being the outstanding young man. I like that young man part of it. I'm telling you a few of these things. I don't like to brag about them, but I'm telling you what is the difference between sobriety and drunkenness. These things, by working with other young people, helped me to stay sober. It helped me to get into the program more deeply than I've ever been before. And then I found something that's bigger than I am. It's called God as I understand Him. Now, I'm not going to get religion on you, because I believe in a power greater than myself. What He looks like, I don't know. But I know it's there, because whenever I call upon His power that's greater than myself, I get the help that I need. Not exactly what I want, but what I need. So I was moonlighting while I was a deputy sheriff. I went to work. I finally got to work at the paper company. I was quite a few years late, but guess what I went to work as? I had the privilege operator's helper. And you can bet I was the best privilege operator's helper that was in there. I worked with a fellow who came from Florida. His name was Reuben. Reuben K. I'm not going to tell you what his full last name is. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Reuben and I, we put out more production than the other three machines put together, because we wasn't always running down to the bathroom. We wasn't in the smoking area at any time. We just got our work in, got our tonnage out, and that was it. And we were allowed to go home. We'd get paid for the full 8 hours. I have to tell you a little story about that, too. When I went and applied for the job at the paper company, I wrote on my application, it said, are you addicted to alcohol or drugs? And I put on there, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Pat Fox, who was the personnel director at that time, I was sitting out in the front here with five other guys that had been there before I was, and he went like this. And I said, me? And he went like this. So I walked in, and he gave me an application. He said, you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I sure am. He said, quite an organization. He said, here, take this back down to Dr. Crane, and if you can pass the examination, he said, you've got a job. Well, remember I told you I have an artificial eye? Shooting a few angles. Well, down to Dr. Crane, first thing you knew, you have to read off the letters in the thing is, they give you the eye test on. He said, now take this in your left hand and place it over your left eye. I did. I read them off just perfect. He said, now put it in your other hand. So I did. And I read it perfect. I was following instructions. About a year later, Jack Trump, who's the assistant personnel man, came around to see me, and he said, hey, Pete, look at me. Yeah, what do you want? He said, you've only got one eye. I said, you're a damn liar. I got two. He said, yeah, but one's artificial. I said, so what? I can see. Now, that time I was in the union, and he couldn't kick me out. Finally, the workload got so heavy for me working with these kids that I finally got a year's leave of absence, and during that year we turned the United Youth Program over to Red Feather campaign, and there on today they call it what has that name they call it now? They have another name for it, the Experimental Youth Program. Now, this is what they're calling it, and it's still flourishing in the county of Muskegon. And they are part of the United Way. Once again, I was instrumental in paying back something that I owe to this program. After about 6 years in Muskegon County, working with these people, I received notice one day from Clayton Walder, who was the clerk of the court, and he said, Judge Gears wants you in his chambers or in his courtroom tomorrow morning at 9 sharp. I said, what the hell does he want now? I had enough kids as it was. We were having a tremendous workload. And I was up there at 9 o'clock sharp, and Clay says, we got to go in, but we got to go in through the big doors. I said, what the hell is this for? So he said, well, the judge just wants this to happen this way. So in the morning, opened the door, and he kind of pushed me in. And when I walked in that courtroom, there was doctors, lawyers, judges, priests, ministers, townspeople, city commissioners, county commissioners. And then I looked over in the corner, and there was Gus Harris, who was the head of the correction department. Guess what went through my mind? God damn, what have I done now I forgot about? Scared to death, shaking all over, the perspiration started to come out. Took us right up the front, Clayton did. He walked over to his little cubicle there, and he said, hear you, search court, county, seeing his mouth in session. Everybody rise. The Honorable Judge Henry L. Beers and John L. Piercy presiding. Before they only had one judge in there, what the hell do they want two judges in here? And here's Gus Harrison sitting there. He said, well, Mr. Peter Slager and Mr. Gus Harrison, please approach the bench. We approached the bench, and he handed the manila envelope about that long, and he presented it to Clayton. Clayton took it out there and presented it to John L. Percy, the judge, and he looked at him, kind of smiled, and handed it to Judge Beers. What the hell's going on here? Why don't somebody tell me something? And about that time, Judge Henry L. Beers started reading. I get kind of emotional when I talk about this. It was a full and complete pardon. First time it's ever happened, set a precedent in the state of Michigan. I received a full and complete pardon. I like to make a little joke about that, but the bottom of the paper says you are now free from any sin or illness. How many of you got one? That made me a number one citizen again. We finally moved up to Montague, Michigan, just off the shores of Lake Michigan, where I'm a member of the White Lake Area Group. In the back of our house is a lake 6 miles long, and on the other side of the house is Lake Michigan. It's a resort area. We have a small group in the winter, but in the summertime, there's a lot of resorters there. We get people from Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, Ohio, and from all over. And our groups usually swell to about 35 in the summertime. It's one of the best groups. Don't say this because I want to hear myself talk, because it is one of the best groups that I've ever been to in my life. On Tuesday night, nobody comes to the meeting without a big book. Nobody comes to the meeting without a 12-12, because if you do, it'll cost you a buck. Well, we have a few cheapskates in there. They don't want to pay the buck. But there's some terrific people in that area. I started working with the townspeople, with the kids around the White Lake Area Group. And I noted one thing in our high school there, they didn't have a track. So I went to one of the townspeople who was very well known there. And of course, every small town has a citizen that usually is one of the outstanding people in the community. And this one happened to be Walter Hunt, who run the Dodge Chrysler Agency. I said, well, how come these kids don't have a track? I said, they're breaking their ankles and everything else on that car path they got up there. Well, he said, we've outlined that out several times. You see, in the last 25 years, we never got together and got the track put out there. Well, I said, if these people would be behind me, we're going to get that money, we're going to get that track. In 4 days, I had $36,500 stuffed in my shirt in cash, negotiable bonds, and securities. I went up to the school board on the following Monday night. I opened up my shirt and I dumped it all on the table. I said, "Let's get a goddamn crack in this town for these kids." They didn't like my language, but 6 days later, it was all complete, even with a fence around it. Today, we have one of the best tracks there is, the regional track meets there is, and for that, I was named Citizen of the Year again. When I came to AA, nobody wanted me except AA. I didn't know it at that time. But when I walked in here the other day, I never seen so much love in all my life. And I sure am glad today that I had the word hate cut out of my fingers. I have some scars there, I remember that. I have a scar here, I remember. I have some scars on my hips. I have a scar on my leg where I was shot. Yeah, when you're in my business, it's a high-risk position. I have made my amends to Judge Gillis before he passed away. And these are the exact words he said to me. "You're one son of a bitch that I thought would never straighten up. God bless you. If there's anything that I can do for you at any time, let me know." And I went back to Detroit, and I let him know he could do something for me for some of the guys that was locked up, to give him a chance. Today I work in the state institution, not as a paid man, but as a volunteer. I try to go each week to the recovery group. This year at our state conference, and three times they've only given away the Shy Walker Award. This year I won it, unbeknownst to myself. There's people that have done less time around AA, but they've worked the program a hell of a lot better than I have, and they received it. But this is only the third time they've awarded that. They're pretty stingy with this thing. Today I can walk into the warden's office, their warden. Now the man is not cleared by lien, but I'll guarantee his conduct in here and coming back out again when you let him in. He always sits down and writes a little pass for the man to get into the institution. I think that I am slowly paying back what is so graciously given me in 1945. I think that I have paid part of my debt to society. And if I stay in this program, I said stay in it. I didn't say stay on it. And if I can remember the last seven words of the 12 steps to practice these principles in all my affairs, I know that I'm not going to have any problems that I can't face. And if I can't face them by myself, I got all of you. This is a program you can take or reject at will. I have a little poem. It was given to me by a very good friend of mine, an ex-convict. He said, "I'd like for you to read this at that conference." So I'm going to read it to you. I haven't memorized it yet. It's called "The World Is Mine." Have you ever heard it? "Today upon a bus I saw a girl with golden hair. She seemed so gay, I envied her and wished that I were half so fair. I watched her as she rose to leave and saw her hobble down the aisle. She had one leg and wore a crutch, but on her face a smile. Oh God, forgive me when I whine. I have two legs. The world is mine." Later on, I bought some sweets. The boy who sold them had such charm. I thought I'd stop and talk a while. I knew it would do no harm. As we walked, as we talked, he said, "Thank you, sir. You've really been so kind. It's nice to talk to folks like you, because you see I'm blind. Oh God, forgive me when I whine. I have two eyes, the world is mine." Later, walking down the street, I met a boy with eyes so blue that he stood and watched the others play. He seemed not knowing what to do. But he looked straight ahead when I asked him, "Why don't you join the others, dear?" And then I knew he couldn't hear. Oh God, forgive me when I whine. I have two ears, the world is mine. Two legs to take me where I go. Two eyes to see the sunset glow. Two ears to hear that all I should hear. Oh God, forgive me when I whine. I'm blessed indeed, the world is mine." I told you that I had five children, two by a previous marriage, and I was just reconciled here just about 2 or 3 weeks ago to my oldest daughter. It took all these years. for me to keep my nose clean and straighten up and fly right. It was one of the greatest reunions I've ever had in my life. I have a son who's 22 years old. He was on top for a while, but he got off of it. Thank God for that. Nearly killed him. And another boy was going down the highway in Michigan, and his friend was killed, and Dave received a broken back. He fully recovered this time and back to work. I saw him down on the farm here a few weeks ago up by Jackson, Michigan. I said, "How you doing, Dave?" He said, "I got off the stuff." He said, "I'm doing fine, Dad." He looked like a picture of health. Then I have a daughter, Kathleen. What's that for a Hollander's name? She's a junior at Michigan State University. Let's hear it for state. If I said that in Michigan, you know that you're going to get some noise. I know there's a certain individual from Ohio State, but we're going to take care of him next week. And then I have my pride and joy, Patrick Michael, 6'8", a little bit older, and a damn good basketball player. Now, there's a lot of contrast to his life and my life. And I wonder sometimes about our children, how well they are doing. But not too long ago, I walked by his bedroom. He's down on his knees. He's saying a prayer. I don't have to wonder any longer. I told you I have a good wife. 5 beautiful children. What more could any man ask? All my life, I have been looking for somebody to care about me that would listen to me. Nobody would listen to what was really in my heart. I remember laying up in that solitary confinement, screaming at the top of my voice and swearing and cursing and yelling and hollering. And I've done something about that. But I like to think back that Father Cahill said a prayer for me. And God heard him. Because God saw something good in me. Because this is what I have been looking for all my life. In closing, I'd just like to say that it really fits me to a T. I sought my soul I could not see. I sought my God eluded me. I sought my fellow man, I found all three. Thank you very much.